Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $700,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Ukraine Crisis and the Challenge of Kremlin Revisionism, and it is presented by the Wheatley Institution at Brigham Young University. Frederick W. Axelgard, a senior fellow in international relations at the Wheatley Institution at Brigham Young University, will introduce our guest.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce Ambassador John Edward Herbst, who will be speaking to you about Ukraine this afternoon. Ambassador Herbst served for 31 years in the U.S. Foreign Service. He retired at the rank of career minister. He was U.S. ambassador in Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. During this time, he worked to enhance U.S.-Ukrainian relations, to help ensure the conduct of fair presidential elections and prevent violence during the Orange Revolution, which took place in that time frame. Prior to that, he was ambassador to Uzbekistan, 2000 to 2003. Again, he played a critical role in the establishment of a U.S. base to help conduct Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. He also promoted improved U.S.-Uzbek relations in part by encouraging Tashkent to improve its human rights record. Prior to serving in Uzbekistan, Ambassador Herbst was Consul General in Jerusalem for 3 years, 1997 to 2000, in effect operating as a U.S. ambassador to the Palestinians. He served as well as Principal Deputy to the Ambassador at Large for the newly independent states of the former Soviet Union, the Director of the Office of Independent States and Commonwealth Affairs, Director of Regional Affairs in the Near East Bureau, and at the embassies in Tel Aviv, Moscow, and Saudi Arabia. I'll add lib just a bit to say that Ambassador Herbst, in his career, made a regular pattern of going from the European Bureau to the Near East Bureau, and has extensive expertise in the Middle East as well as Russian and East European affairs. Ambassador Herbst earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Foreign Service from Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, Phi Beta Kappa, and has also achieved a Master of Law and Diplomacy degree with distinction from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He also attended the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies Bologna Center. He and his late wife, Nadia Christoph Herbst, have 5 children and 5 grandchildren. And ladies and gentlemen, again, it's my sincere pleasure to introduce to you Ambassador John Edward Herbst.
We're going to talk about Ukraine today, but the Ukraine crisis is really a crisis of two parts or two elements. The first, of course, it's a struggle for the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Ukraine in the face of a hybrid war launched by the Kremlin against Ukraine. So that's the one aspect of it, and that's the one that's gotten most of the attention. The second aspect, however, is probably more important, unless you happen to be Ukrainian. And that is, it's a question of a Kremlin policy of revising the borders and the settlement that emerged in the post-Cold War world when the Soviet Union fell apart. Mr. Putin has said that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, a century which witnessed, of course, the Holocaust under Hitler, the Holodomor, the terror famine that Stalin imposed on Ukraine, the murder of tens of millions of people in China and also in Russia under Mao on the one hand and Stalin on the other. Yet for Mr. Putin, the worst thing that happened in the 20th century was the decline of the country that gave us the Gulag, the Soviet Union. And Mr. Putin has said that he has the right and in fact the duty, to protect ethnic Russians wherever they live, and Russian speakers, not just ethnic Russians, Russian speakers wherever they live. And many Russians and Russian speakers live in Kazakhstan, in Lithuania, excuse me, in Estonia, in Latvia, and in other countries on the borders of Russia. So Mr. Putin has ambitions to revise the international order that go well beyond Ukraine. And we need to keep this in mind as we look at what's happening in Ukraine. So with that as a general introduction, I'd like to go through the crisis for you and describe where we are today and what I believe the United States and our European allies should be doing to deal with this situation. This crisis began in November of 2013 because the then president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, someone that Mr. Putin liked and worked with, was about to sign a trade agreement with the European Union. And that trade agreement would have made it much easier for Ukraine to sell products to Europe. Those, so it would have been good for the Ukrainian economy. And Mr. Putin objected to this. And for that reason, and I think there are also domestic reasons in Ukraine as well, Yanukovych decided he was not going to sign the agreement. This is an agreement that Ukraine had negotiated with the EU for several years, and it was quite popular in Ukraine. The day after Mr. Yanukovych said this, there were tens of thousands of people demonstrating in the main square in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, the Maidan. They said, "We don't like this, Mr. Yanukovych. Change your mind." And here, Yanukovych made a very important mistake. Instead of letting them demonstrate and maybe listening to them in some form, he sent his police in to use shields and truncheons to break up the demonstration. Now, I served in Ukraine during the Orange Revolution from 2003 to 2006, and it was clear to me from my experience at that time that, by and large, the Ukrainian people are not happy with government that uses force to break up peaceful demonstrations. And in fact, the day after the police came in to clear the square, they were not fully successful. Instead of facing a demonstration of tens of thousands of people, Mr. Yanukovych was facing a demonstration of hundreds of thousands. And they were not demonstrating about the agreement with the European Union, they were demonstrating against the increasingly authoritarian policies of President Yanukovych and his government. And those people stayed on the Maidan, not all several hundred thousand of them, but at least tens of thousands of them, and at times swelling again to hundreds of thousands, from the end of November until February 22nd, when Mr. Yanukovych fled Ukraine. At that point in time, you know, from November to February of last year, this was largely, but not entirely, a domestic crisis, a domestic Ukrainian crisis. However, and this comes back to that other thing I mentioned at the start, the objectives of Mr. Putin and his government, it's interesting and significant that in this period, the Kremlin was urging Yanukovych to use a steel fist to deal with his demonstrators. They explicitly argued for using violence. Now, why did Mr. Yanukovych flee? What prompted him to go? Well, he alternated in this three-month period between repression and, I would say, quasi or pseudo concessions to get the demonstrators to disperse. By mid-February, he decided to throw the dice. And we still don't know precisely who is responsible for this, but on the week of February 18 or 19, there suddenly appeared on the buildings high above the streets of Kyiv, snipers. And these snipers began to shoot demonstrators, as a result of which about 100 people died. According to Russian TV, and which is a propaganda arm of the Kremlin, it was the demonstrators who were doing the shooting. According to most reliable information, it was either Ukrainian special police units called Berkut, who were under the control of Yanukovych, or it was Russian special agents, or a combination of the two. At a minimum, Yanukovych was complicit in sniper fire on his own peacefully demonstrating citizens. The other explanation is he ordered it. In any case, as this occurred, the reaction in the streets was very, very sharp. And the reaction in the country more broadly was sharp. And Yanukovych realized he had no future in Ukraine. And so he fled to Russia. And an interim government emerged. And then, of course, there was a presidential election in late May of last year where you had a new president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko. But with the flight of Yanukovych, a crisis that was largely domestic suddenly became international. Now, again, even people who were not following Ukraine to any extent at that time all learned about, in late February, early March, little green men. Little green men were the soldiers without a patch identifying their country who appeared in the streets of Crimea, who began to take over the peninsula. And they took over the peninsula to keep out the government in Kiev. And within a matter of weeks, there was no resistance by Ukrainian authorities to this takeover. Within a matter of weeks, they had secured control of the whole of Crimea. And a few weeks after that, the parliament in Russia, the Duma, annexed Crimea to Russia. And Mr. Putin, of course, welcomed this in a celebratory speech. A few weeks after that, Putin himself acknowledged that those, in fact, were Russian troops, those little green men. This was an initial response by the Kremlin to the people of Ukraine taking control of their own future and kicking out a tyrant who had permitted, if not ordered, the sniper fire, the murder of 80 to 100 peacefully demonstrating Ukrainians. But Mr. Putin had a problem as he seized Crimea. Ukraine has differences in political outlook in different parts of the country. Since the country's independence in 1991, these differences have become smaller, but they remain real even today. And a simple way to describe it is, in the west of the country, the people look towards Europe as a sort of cultural and political lodestar, and they want a closer relationship with Europe. In the east of Ukraine and in the south, people look more towards Russia culturally. In Crimea, which was the only region of Ukraine where the majority ethnic group was Russian, the last census was 2002, and at that time there were like 56-57% ethnic Russians in Crimea. That figure is undoubtedly lower today. But so the Kremlin realized, even as they grabbed Crimea, that this made their interest and their ability to control events in Ukraine, in the country as a whole, more difficult. Because the group that was most favorably disposed to them were no longer part of the Ukrainian political system. So what is Putin to do with this circumstance? He begins a covert war in Ukraine's east, in the famous region called the Donbas, region famous for its production of coal. And have a heavy industry. Now, over the past 15 years, including during my time in Ukraine and very recently, Mr. Putin has misunderstood the character of the Ukrainian people and their sympathy, allegiance towards Moscow. Essentially, he felt that a substantial percentage and perhaps even a majority, not just in Crimea, but in Ukraine's east, ultimately were going to be more loyal to Moscow than to Kiev. He thought this in spite of the fact that even in Crimea, in February of last year, in January of last year, before the Russians seized it, Polls showed that only 40 or 42% of the population would be interested in either independence from Ukraine or joining Russia. So even in the most pro-Russian part of Ukraine, a majority were not interested in leaving Ukraine. And Mr. Putin thought that in Ukraine's east, there would be many local people who would say no to the government in Kyiv. And not only would they say no, they'd be willing to fight the government in Kyiv. You know, pick up arms and attack Ukrainian institutions in the east. Well, that didn't turn out so well for the Kremlin, because, in fact, there were very few people who were willing to do that. Over the past 20-plus years of Ukraine's independence, as I said, the differences between East and West have grown smaller, and this is felt especially among the young people. So, for example, polls in the eastern part, in the Donbas region, taken last spring, showed that only 20 to 25% of the population would be interested in leaving Ukraine or joining Russia. And though that 25% was overwhelmingly 50 years of age and older, your best soldiers are not 65 years old. They're the young. And the young were not interested in this enterprise. So what happened was that to have an insurrection in the east, the Kremlin had to send in leadership, money, weapons, and, as things developed, actual fighters. The principal leader of the Russian military engagement, the secret engagement, last spring and summer in the east, was a Colonel Girkin. He was a colonel in the FSB, which is the Russian equivalent of the FBI. Albeit, since Russia is an authoritarian regime, the FSB does many nasty things which our FBI does not do. And Mr. Girkin would use, at times, non-secure communication to talk to his masters in Moscow. And some of these communications have been intercepted and are public. And among them are statements like, no one here wants to fight, so we need fighters to come in from Russia. In any case, from early April, when the insurrection began, the Russian-led finance, etc. insurrection began in the east, up until late May, when Poroshenko was elected president, or maybe a few weeks after that, early June, the rebels were able to make serious progress in the east. They started out by seizing parts of the cities of Luhansk and Donetsk, and they moved outward from there in both directions. But in early June, the new president, Poroshenko, said, we're going to begin what he called a counter-terrorist operation, which I would describe simply as a counter-offensive. And from early June up until the middle of August, the Ukrainian military and their secret police and their Ministry of Interior, which is the police, conducted an operation which steadily took back parts of most of the Donbas from the Russians and their puppets. This despite the fact, as the Ukrainian counteroffensive, you know, gained strength, the Kremlin sent in heavy weapons like T-64 tanks, which are not the latest tanks, but they're still pretty efficient, armored personnel carriers, anti-aircraft artillery, including the anti-aircraft artillery that shot down the Malaysian airliner, and fighters. They sent in something called the Vostok, which means east in Russian, the Vostok Battalion, which was made up largely of Chechens. Despite all of these efforts, the Ukrainian military continued moving forward very successfully. And let me back up here to point out one important factor that played throughout this period. The Kremlin was violating international law by seizing Crimea, by conducting this secret war in Ukraine's east, although the Europeans, who were reluctant to acknowledge what Putin was doing, hid behind the fact that the Russian activity in the east was largely secret. The shoot down of the airliner made it clear that the Russians were engaged. In fact, some very excellent reporting has been done recently in Germany and the Netherlands on what happened with the shootdown of the airliner. But in any case, the West began to levy sanctions on Russia, economic sanctions, for this. But the sanctions that were levied required substantial American leadership, which is good, of course. And even with that, the sanctions were relatively weak and relatively slow in coming. Even after the shootdown of the airliner, it was slow in coming. But the threat of additional sanctions was one of the reasons why Putin wanted to keep his war secret. He wanted to give the Europeans reason not to levy sanctions. In any case, by the middle of August, Putin had a serious problem. Everything he was doing, which was quasi-secret, was proving to be unable to stop the Ukrainian counteroffensive. So a point was reached where either he had to intervene with his own army, or Ukraine was going to take back all of its country in the east, Crimea being separate in this conversation. So he sent the army in. And the Russian army is much stronger than the Ukrainian army. And within a matter of a week, they dealt a serious defeat to the Ukrainians, who had to retreat. But Putin sent in something like 5,000 or more than 5,000 soldiers to do this. And the whole world knew it, with the exception of the Russian people. Putin has vast control over media in Russia, and the line he has taken is there are no Russian soldiers, active duty Russian soldiers in Ukraine. So the Russian people don't know about this. They say some of them do, but the official line is there are none. And for that reason, Russian dead are buried in secret. Their mothers don't really know what happened to them. Putin also agreed in early September to a ceasefire. And he agreed to that ceasefire because he was trying to avert more sanctions. But the Europeans at that point were no longer to be dissuaded. And they put down serious sanctions in July. The Europeans put down those similarly serious sanctions in September. And so we had a ceasefire. But the ceasefire, which began September 5 and continues to this day, has not been really observed on the Russian side, on the separatist side. There have been 225, actually the data I'm giving you comes from a trip I took last week to Ukraine, so it's a little bit OBE. As of last Thursday or Friday, there were 225 dead Ukrainian soldiers from September 5. The Russians and their surrogates in eastern Ukraine have gained an additional 500 square kilometers since the ceasefire began in early September. And in the last month, according to Ukrainian intelligence, according to Western intelligence, including American intelligence, the Russians have put substantially more heavy military equipment into the east. Hundreds of tanks, armored personnel carriers, and advanced anti-aircraft missile systems. And artillery. But over the past 8 or 9 days, we've seen a substantial increase of shelling coming from the separatists and their Russian backers. And we've seen some efforts by the separatists to move out beyond the current lines of conflict and take more territory. So that's the situation we've got today. I think it's safe to assume that we will see probably only one more, burst of aggression coming from the Kremlin and its surrogates in eastern Ukraine. The aggression is likely to come in one of two areas. One, the more ambitious project would be to establish a land corridor from Western Russia, the border with eastern Ukraine, to the Crimea. And that's like 200, 300 kilometers. The less ambitious but still ambitious objective would be to push out from their current positions in the Luhansk and Donetsk areas and seize the entire oblast of Luhansk and Donetsk. An oblast in Ukraine is like a county in the United States. And they control only, I don't know, 10%, 15% of the oblast of Luhansk and Donetsk. Well, maybe they try and push out to control the entire oblast. The purpose of either would be to be able to destabilize Ukraine so it cannot move in a clear direction towards democracy and a market economy. That would be the objective. Okay, so that's where we are. At the meantime, because of sanctions and because of the low price of oil, Mr. Putin is in serious trouble at home. That has not deterred him yet from his aggressive war in Ukraine. I believe it might in the future. And so I realize I'm just about out of time for my set remarks, so I will conclude here by saying what the United States in particular and the West in general should do to deal with this problem. I give President Obama high marks for leading Europe to implement serious sanctions against the Kremlin for their aggression in Ukraine. That's very good. But there are two other areas where we need a strong policy where, frankly, we don't have it. I mentioned a minute ago that Putin is vulnerable to casualties. The Russian people have said in numerous polls, Russian soldiers should not be fighting in Ukraine. So Putin has said to the Russian people, the only Russians fighting in Ukraine are volunteers, even though that's not true. So we need to help Ukraine inflict more casualties on Russian aggressors in Ukraine. We should be providing Ukraine with defensive lethal equipment, for example, with javelin systems which blow up tanks and armored personnel carriers. We should be giving them help in intelligence areas. We should be giving them, well, this is part of help in intelligence areas, unmanned aerial vehicles. We should be considering giving them anti-aircraft batteries. But we have a policy, which I think is extremely short-sighted, of providing no weapons to Ukraine. Congress passed legislation a month ago saying we should be giving weapons to Ukraine and authorizing the president to do so. But the president has been reluctant under the misguided argument that that will lead to an escalation, which ignores the fact we've seen about five or six escalations of the conflict on the Russian side. If the Kremlin knows that it will have more casualties as a result of their aggression, it's less likely the Kremlin will escalate. We have to give Ukraine defensive lethal weapons to reduce the possibility of further escalation. So that's an area where the president's policy is not working properly and needs to change. The other area where our policy is weak is regards NATO. I mentioned and gave some instances of why the problem of Ukraine is really a problem of Russian revisionism, a revisionism that extends beyond Ukraine. Mr. Putin has made this clear just in the past few months. There was a NATO summit in Wales in early September. That summit took some rather weak measures to address the Russian danger. The day that summit ended, the Russians kidnapped an Estonian official from Estonia. This was the Kremlin's way of telling the Baltic states, if you think NATO will protect you, think again. And NATO did nothing in response to that kidnapping. The Kremlin also seized a Lithuanian ship in international waters of the Baltic Sea. Another message to the Baltic nations that you are not secure. The summit in Wales, the NATO summit in Wales, said that, yes, there's a danger from Russia, but frankly, the true national security danger to NATO is ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon. Levant. That's just strategically stupid. Yes, ISIL is a danger, no doubt about it. ISIL has the ability to kill Americans or Europeans or Arabs, whom they kill mainly Arabs. They kill mainly Muslims. But Russia, which is one of the world's two great nuclear powers, which launched an aggressive war against Georgia to change territory, which launched an aggressive war against Ukraine to change territory, is a much more dangerous threat. And the Wales summit, and remember that the United States is easily the most influential member in NATO, and if there's going to be a serious NATO policy, the U.S. has to be leading. All we agreed in Wales was to establish a rapid reaction force, which had actually been worked on. We were working on that long before the Russian aggression in Ukraine began. So while at Wales we said it was about Russia, this project began without any reference to an aggressive Kremlin. And we decided to put a company of soldiers into the Baltic countries. You know, a company of soldiers, what's that, 40, 50, 80 people? NATO needs to say we have to review our relationship with Russia. We need to put some serious military assets in the Baltic states, like a battalion, like some tanks, some anti-aircraft stuff, fighters. And we should be talking about doing this for a prolonged period until the danger from the Kremlin eases. That will only happen with intelligent and persistent, determined, in better word, American leadership, which we have not seen. Bottom line, if Mr. Putin succeeds with his aggression in Ukraine, he will strike elsewhere. I'm not certain where that elsewhere is, but the possibilities include Kazakhstan, the Baltic states, Georgia again, Moldova. We have a problem which we will only be able to manage or defeat by clear thinking and a strong defense and economic posture. Thank you.
All right, as we open up for questions, please speak into the microphone, state your name and something about yourself. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for the talk. It was excellent. I'm Richard Buck. I'm an economics student here at the University of Utah, and I was interested in hearing your thoughts on how the sort of economic recessions and depressions that Ukraine and Russia are suffering from right now are going to influence the conflict in the coming months, whether or not that might make Russia more aggressive to try and persuade its citizens that everything's fine, that the West is the real problem causing something, or possible de-escalation.
Okay. Economics are important, are extremely important in all areas of life, including international affairs. And economics play a very important role in this crisis. Ukraine is dealing, in effect, with two crises. I've been only talking about one, the question of Kremlin aggression. The other is an economic and social system which is overwhelmingly corrupt, which needs to be transformed. And along with that, they have an immediate debt crisis. They owe something like $15 billion to international creditors. So for Ukraine to succeed, I said this crisis was about both Kremlin revisionism on the one side and whether Ukraine would be a sovereign and a territorially intact government on the other. For Ukraine to be that, to be sovereign and territorially intact, it needs to undertake serious reform. And we have seen, the government talks a good game. We have seen some efforts on reform in Ukraine over the past couple of months, but not nearly enough. So this has to happen. This has to happen. And Ukraine needs substantial help from the West to deal with its international debt problem. The IMF has said it's prepared to provide a financial package, but the package the IMF is willing to provide is not large enough to deal with Ukraine's need. The United States has been good on this as well. We've pledged up to $2 billion. So if the IMF provides five or six, we pledge two. Well, you still need to get another six or seven. So that's part of this. But then, of course, part of the Russian war against Ukraine involves economic tools, involves gas, for example, the supply of energy. On the Russian side, there are some serious economic problems now. One of the reasons why Mr. Putin remains very popular in Russia is when he arrived in power, Russia was in very bad straits economically. This was shortly after the recession of 1998, which hit Russia very hard. But around the same time that Putin came to power, oil and gas prices began to rise. And Russia's economy depends overwhelmingly on the export of hydrocarbons. And as a consequence, Russia went from being a poor country to being pretty much a medium-income country during Mr. Putin's tenure. And this has made him popular in Russia, this more than anything else. His problem now is not just the sanctions which we put down, but the fact that the price of oil is under $50 a barrel. You know, just this past summer, it was $100 a barrel. And a few years ago, it was heading towards 120, 130, even 150 for brief periods of time. And he does not have the money at his disposal today that he had a mere 6 months ago. And keep in mind that the whole world was fooled by the precipitous drop in oil prices over the past several months. So it's not like the Kremlin planners were trying to figure out how they're going to manage this in the past. And my read of the oil world is that oil prices, they may not go down much more, although they may, but they're not going to go up much beyond 60 for several years. And for Putin, that's a serious blow. It makes the sanctions we put down much more effective because Russian companies need to refinance loans they have from Western institutions, and because of the sanctions, they can't do that. So the Kremlin has to withdraw its own substantial reserves that it built up over the past 9 or 10 years of high oil prices. We don't have exact figures on those reserves, but people were talking about Russian losing about $100 billion worth of reserves over the past year, and it'll get worse this coming year in terms of their need to draw on that. So this is a serious problem for Mr. Putin, and living standards in Russia are already down over the past few months, and it's going to get a lot worse. So it's possible, as you suggest in your question, that this will be an incentive for him to take one last stab at aggression in Ukraine. The only problem with that is he has the strength to seize additional territory. It's not clear he has the strength to hold it, because there will be a guerrilla war conducted by the citizens of Ukraine against an occupiers from Russia. That doesn't mean he fully understands that. So it's possible we will see another spasm of violence. But I believe that if he cannot get the Europeans to lift their sanctions in September, and I think it's probable he will not definite, but probable, then he's got a major political problem due precisely to because of his aggression in Ukraine. And I'm not certain what he'll do with that over time. I do believe that either, you know, if all these things continue, the low oil prices, the sanctions, I do believe that in 2 years, either Russia will be stepping back from its aggression in Ukraine, leaving Crimea to the side for the moment, or the Kremlin will be having serious political problems at home.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Matt Burmeister. I'm an instructor in the Department of Military Science and a Master of Public Policy student. Thank you for your time. I was wondering if I could ask your opinion about an article I read this morning. It was acknowledging U.S. Army Europe's approval to conduct a training operation with Ukrainian National Guard units.
Right.
I believe it was a small contingent, sir, proportionally to kind of like along the lines you were talking about. Is this type of policy significant? What are the ramifications for security snowball effects in the area if they do it?
The Ukrainian military has many serious problems due to years of neglect and corruption. So training is certainly a very good thing, and I am somewhat familiar with the program. There's a Major General Key who is running it, and I think it's very good, and it's a real contribution. And I think the idea is if this is successful, then there'd be efforts to do training on a broader basis. The problem, though, well, it's not the problem, but that's important, and we should continue doing it, and we should do more of it. That, however, is not going to stop Putin's next step of aggression, because the fruits of training are going to be months away, if not years away. And that's why we need the weapons. But over time, if policy works in the right direction, we will have a much more intense or much broader training program, and thanks in part to the weapons we supply, Russian aggression will cease in Ukraine's east.
My name is Christian Mickelson. I'm a economics and political science major, and while I was listening to you talk, I started thinking about what you said at the beginning about there being two sides to this conflict. You have the Ukraine side where they're worried about getting taken over, and then you have the Kremlin reorganization, and assuming that the sanctions do get lifted and Russia starts to regain some of the power it has lost over the past year, what would be the worst scenario looking at the Kremlin taking over Ukraine and then that giving them energy to move forward, or would it be just the Kremlin working with the countries around it, given that you said Putin was a dangerous man?
Well, it's possible that sanctions will be lifted even as Putin continues his aggression in Ukraine. But I don't think that's likely. If sanctions are lifted and Putin continues to aggression in Ukraine, Ukraine will remain unstable for as long as such policies are in place. which will take, which may be years, And Putin would be emboldened to look out for opportunities elsewhere, because he has the doctrine, and he has demonstrated by various provocations his intent to go further, which is why we need to do a lot more in Ukraine, because if we don't stop him in Ukraine, we may have to deal with him elsewhere. And we really don't want him playing around with the Baltic states, because they're members of NATO, and we are obligated to defend NATO members, including with American soldiers. So Putin needs a very clear message in Ukraine so he doesn't do anything really provocative and stupid in the Baltics. Now, if your question was, well, sanctions are lifted because Russia stops its aggression in Ukraine, and Russia therefore is in a position to prosper, that's fine with me. The United States has nothing against a prosperous Russia. I have nothing against a prosperous Russia. I think that's a good thing. What we don't want is a prosperous, aggressive Russia. The problem here is Putin's aggressive designs, and we need to make clear to him that he will pay too high a price for aggression. And our policy only does that properly in the sanctions area, not in the area of NATO policy and weapons for Ukraine.
Hi, thank you for... Am I on?
Please.
Thank you for coming here and explaining to us all of this process. I'm JR, and I'm a psychology major. I was thinking about when my sister used to live in Portugal, she was saying that most of the younger generation were like coming to U.S. or trying to go to France because of the economy, the way it was.
I'm sorry, coming from where?
Portugal.
Portugal, okay.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to picture the whole scene on that side of the globe. And so when you talk about Russia, we did a study about some human resistance to progress. And I have to admit that I'm ignorant about Russian history. So I would like to know, in your opinion, what is the problem with this resistance to understand maybe the capitalism or the economy the way it is now from the Russians?
Okay. I'm not certain that I would say that the Russian people are unable to understand capitalism. I think that in the post-Soviet Russia, they have understood that capitalism in some form is the way you have to organize your economy. And there are economists in Russia, and for that matter others besides economists, who understand the importance of establishing rule of law in order for both a society to progress and for an economy to progress. But unfortunately, in Russia, and not just in Russia, the elites that controlled the country at independence, the old Soviet elites, retained a substantial amount of control post-independence. And they were all for capitalism, but for the kind that they call crony capitalism, where because you are a powerful member of the government, you use your power to take possession of the economic resources of the country. And that was true. That was and is true in Russia. That was and still is true in Ukraine, although they seem to be trying to break away, not fast enough for my taste. The problem with crony capitalism is it offers only limited opportunities for those who are not the cronies. And what it really does, and this is the really unfortunate thing, it stifles entrepreneurship. The key to economic growth is entrepreneurship. The guy who says, I've got an idea, and I'm going to use everything I've got, everything in my brain, in my wallet, to make this idea real. I mean, that's what Bill Gates was, right? That's what Steve Jobs was, way back when they were working in their parents' garages. For all of its talent, I mean, Russia has produced extraordinary scientists, extraordinary intellectuals. Where's the Russian Bill Gates? The same is true with Ukraine. The reason why there's no Russian Bill Gates is because the guys who have that talent, who start to do something, what do they find? As soon as they develop something big enough to attract some notice, a guy with power takes it away. That's why there are a lot of smart, young, and middle-aged Russians in Germany, in Europe. The guys who didn't have political cover. And the same is true in Ukraine. Same is true in Ukraine. That's the problem. Somehow, and this is interesting, I don't know enough about China. They've managed to escape this. People who've and despite the fact they still have communist leadership, I mean technically communist leadership, and in political sense communist leadership, some people who talk about this point out correctly that there's been centuries of Chinese, great Chinese traders and capitalists, whereas that really isn't quite true in Russia, which had a largely feudal system up until, you know, the late 19th century. So that clearly has a hand in this. And somehow the Chinese leadership knew they had to allow people to profit, people who weren't necessarily powerful in themselves to profit, in order for their country to work. And of course, the Chinese growth has been absolutely extraordinary. And China is a danger to the United States. Excuse me. China has the potential to be a much greater danger to the United States than Putin's Russia, because they have a world-class economy, which Russia does not. It has a hydrocarbon economy. It's, you know, Saudi Arabia plus nukes and a different language and an alphabet. Anyway.
Thank you for appreciating President Obama's approach to this, because many people seem not to like him anymore.
I only partly appreciate his approach to this.
But anyway, it's good to hear.
I give him much higher marks on Iran than I do on Ukraine.
It's good to hear that somebody still sees him as a powerful man. I do. Also, thank you for reminding us about the media process in Russia, because recently I saw on TV that the president tries to kind of suppress the media there.
Oh, he's done that. Absolutely. By the way, there's a statement by perhaps the most eminent Russian historian, a guy named Kluchevsky, who says that there's an inverse but precise relationship between the expansion of Russia abroad and the repression of Russians at home. And certainly the Putin episode in Russian history demonstrates that, because he has become increasingly authoritarian. And as he's become increasingly authoritarian at home, he's becoming increasingly aggressive abroad. So our policies, which are clearly, the policies I recommend, which are clearly anti-Putin, are actually pro-people of Russia.
I've got a quick question for you. I'm John Rossi. I'm a political science major. And over the past couple of months, I've seen a couple articles come out that anti-American sentiment in Russia is the highest it's been since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and as well as Soviet Union sentiments are the highest they've been since that period as well. There's also a couple other things that might go along with that. But what validity do you think there is in the question, did the Soviet Union really die?
The Soviet Union really died. And the security danger that Putin represents, while I think it's easily the greatest danger in the world today, is not as great as the danger posed by the Soviet Union, for a variety of reasons, which I won't go into, because we have other people who want to ask questions. It's absolutely true that the anti-American sentiment in Russia today is greater than even in Soviet times. And there's a very simple reason for that. Or actually two simple reasons for that. First is, the Russian media is pretty slick. The packaging is pretty good. The resources devoted to it are substantial. So it has an ability to draw people in. And along with that, Mr. Putin has cut off almost all alternate sources of information. In his early leadership days, he took control of the major TV stations but left everything else alone. Over the past 2 years, he's taken over all media, I mean all TV, almost all newspapers, not just the big ones, not quite all, but almost all. And he's now even going after the internet in a big way, following the Arab Spring. So at this same time, you know, we cut back all of our broadcasting to Russia from the Cold War days. We have a very small program today as compared with 25 years ago. And while we've upped our program some over the past 6 months, it's really still a fraction of what it had been 2 decades back. Anyway, that's one reason. The information available is all of a certain kind. And the other is, Putin has been pushing anti-American themes in a major way especially the last, say, 6 years since the Georgia War, but even more the last year. The virulence of the anti-American message is probably higher than at any time in Soviet period, even in the blackest days of Stalin's rule. So what do you expect? Having said all that, this could all come crashing down in weeks if circumstances in Russia get very bad, because certainly elites understand the connection between the Kremlin aggression abroad and the sanctions, and at least part of their economic problems at home. Given the low price of oil, they desperately need the lifting of the financial sanctions. But as long as those sanctions remain firm, and again, I think it's likely they will, Russia has a serious problem.
Could you describe to us what these sanctions are? I keep hearing about them, but I can't give a good description.
The sanctions essentially say that it is illegal for certain entities to have access to Western markets. And so this includes major banks in Russia. This includes actually many financial institutions. This includes major companies, particularly in the hydrocarbon area, that need both technology as well as investment from the West. So this is Russian firms that have debt that has to be repaid cannot go to Western banks to get lending to do it, whereas they had tens of billions of dollars worth of loans, which are coming due over time, for which they will not have Western resources to address. So this is leading to less economic activity in Russia. It has a multiplier effect, again, especially with low prices for oil.
Corey Bourne, you stated that you advised that U.S. weaponry be given to Ukrainians right. in order to increase the casualties so the Russians have to admit that Russian nationals are fighting on their soils.
Right.
With Mr. Putin's increased control of their media, wouldn't the minute a U.S. missile slammed in one of their tanks, he could spin it, coupled with our sanctions, that we are attacking them, and therefore possibly with that give them the resolve to do something even more aggressive?
I don't have any doubt that that's the way he would play it. The problem he has in trying to spin that is that the Russian soldiers who are hit by these missiles are fighting in Ukraine. And he's denying that that's what's happening. So we're not attacking, the weapons that we provide would not be attacking Russians in Russia, be attacking Russians in Ukraine. So I suspect that impact, the impact of the acknowledgement that Russian soldiers are fighting in Ukraine would be much stronger than the impact of his effort to say this is America fighting against Russia. Let's remember that we provided all sorts of weapons to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight successfully the Soviet invasion in the 1980s.
We have time for one more question, if anybody.
Hi, Zhenya Jolly. I am a native Ukrainian, actually. I was living in Ukraine during the Orange Revolution, southeast Mariupol.
Ah, okay.
And I was just wondering, looking at our my country's history of leadership and government, how promising do you think is Poroshenko? And
I know him well. I dealt with him a lot when I was in Kyiv. He's a very smart man. He's held almost every senior position in the Ukrainian government. I think he understands that reform is important for Ukraine. I think he also is someone who's been very successful in a world of Ukrainian oligarchs and political powers where oligarchs play a major role, and he's not uncomfortable in that world. So I think we have to appeal to his better side and his better nature to encourage him to make the reforms that are absolutely essential for his country's future. And so our policy needs to be one of providing support to Ukraine on the economic side, including material support, but also tough love advice. In other words, we should not be opening our wallets if they're not making the reforms needed. Because if they receive our money and don't make the reforms, that will simply make wealthy Ukrainians wealthier, as opposed to helping making Ukraine a modern, successful economy.
All right. Thank you all for being here. Please join me in thanking our guests for their time.